Welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today's sponsors are Blue Apron and Audible, with an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more. Get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial at www.audible.com/undisclosed. Enjoy the addendum.
Hello, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. I am John Cryer, and this is the podcast about all things undisclosed. The addendum allow us avid listeners to take a deep dive into the latest episode. Season 2 of Undisclosed is investigating the State versus Joey Watkins, a case of a young man who may well have spent the last 16 years in prison for a crime that he did not commit. With us today are Colin Miller and Susan Simpson, the hosts of Undisclosed. Say hello, Colin.
Hey, John.
And Susan.
Hey.
You worked on that, hey. We also have with us a couple of very special guests. We have Julie Seaman, who is an associate professor at Emory University School of Law. She teaches courses and seminars in evidence, constitutional law, and freedom of speech. She also serves as the president of the board of the Georgia Innocence Project. Hello, Julie.
Hi.
Thank you for being here today.
Of course. I'm happy to be here.
And we also have Brooke Giddings, who is a social worker, a therapist, a nanny, and the host of the Actual Innocence podcast, which is dedicated to telling the stories of people who've been convicted and then exonerated of crimes that they did not commit in their own voices. She's also a producer of Undisclosed. How you doing, Brooke?
I am amazing. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. Now, Brooke, I just wanted to start with a quick question for you. Why did you start the Actual Innocence podcast?
That is a great question. I listened to Serial and I listened to Undisclosed. And apparently I was a very naive person because I didn't realize that people actually got wrongly convicted. And so since I didn't know, I assumed that maybe there were lots of other people who didn't know. And I feel like that needed to be changed. And so my strength is talking to people. So I thought by making a podcast, talking to people, I could help more people know about wrongful convictions and bring awareness to the cause.
I was curious, how do you get in touch and find the stories of these people?
I would tell you, but I would have to kill you.
Okay, sorry. It's apparently a trade secret.
No, it's interesting. I have a lot of connections with Innocence Projects, and some people, they find me, you know, they hear about my podcast, and they also want to be advocates because they don't want the same thing to happen to other people. And so they find me and they want to tell their story.
Now, I find when I listen to the show that it is just absolutely heartbreaking to me. And considering that you're a therapist, do you ever end up having to be your own therapist after doing these interviews?
Sometimes. In my job as a therapist, I actually work with children. So it's kind of a different population. But yeah, I mean, I use a lot of my own coping skills and self-care and relaxation, you know, after listening to these stories, for sure.
Because they are stories of exonerees. There's always obviously something of a happy ending. But to me, the tragedy of these things is what always gets me. And your show is just so beautifully produced. And it's really remarkable what it does.
Thank you very much. I was talking to someone just yesterday, and he was talking about how you don't give up hope and, you know, his morale had armor around it. I told him, I said, when I wait 15 minutes in line at the pharmacy, you know, my morale is busted. And he waited 15 years for his appeals to go through. And he said, no, I didn't lose my morale because I knew I was innocent. So it's just amazing the hope that these people have and they see it as a happy ending.
Well, also, I hope that you folks are understanding that you're bringing such a depth of knowledge to people who listen to these podcasts that if ever there's some way to help people from falling into this type of situation in the future, it's because of what you guys are doing. You know, that I think is a huge service.
Yeah, and I think Brooke's podcast really puts a face to the statistics. We often hear the numbers about false convictions and whether they're based upon faulty eyewitness testimony, a false confession. You sort of aggregate those, but then it's really great, I think, to listen to Brooke's podcast and you hear these stories. And the thing is, most of the people are not bitter. They have lost a lot of their lives to false incarceration, but they're so hopeful and they really are able to lend a great perspective as to this entire criminal justice complex that we have and how individual people, families, lives are affected.
There is this exoneree that I interviewed. His name is Derek Bunkley, and he is a young Black man, and he lives in Detroit. And oftentimes I ask the exonerees, how are you doing now? And I hear things like, you know, I like to travel, I spend time with my family, I go on these vacations. And it's because they've won these settlements. But Derek Bunkley, his goals to me were, I want to get my own place and I want to buy a car. And I know that he's working because I scheduled his interview around his job, but he had such a positive outlook on life. And so that was so inspiring to me that this person who it seems like the world is against him and his goals are to get his own place and to get a car is still hopeful and has a positive outlook after all these adverse things have happened to him.
Actually, that was always something that struck me is that in some of these exoneree cases, they do get fairly large cash payouts. It's not in all cases by any means. But my understanding is they've been given no skills to cope with those things financially. And I can't imagine they have the skills to handle that well. And Julie, actually, because you work with the Georgia Innocence Project, I was curious if you'd observed that with some of the exonerees you've dealt with.
Different states have different procedures for compensating exonerees, and not every state has any kind of anything for compensation. But in Georgia, they do it through private bills. And so usually a law firm will take a case pro bono when we have an exoneration, and they'll help that person get a private bill passed to compensate them for some amount. But yeah, I mean, several of our exonerees are in really bad shape financially. And part of it is that they don't really get that much, kind of swimming out there on their own without a lot of resources. And the Georgia Innocence Project has a program called Life After Exoneration, where we try to help people because there are so many issues after exoneration. But, you know, we barely have any money to do our main mission. And that's something that we'd like to do if we had more resources, but it's really, really hard.
Audible is a leading provider of premium digital spoken audio information and entertainment on the internet. Audible content includes an unmatched selection of audiobooks and other audio products such as news programs and magazines. Users can sign up as an Audible listener, which gives them book credits and access to short programs now playing in channels each month for a low monthly fee. Customers simply download their choices and can access them on their iPhone, Android device, Fire tablet, iPod, or other MP3 player. And now Undisclosed listeners get a special deal. You can get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial at www.audible.com/undisclosed. Now here are a couple of things I especially like about Audible. Unlike a streaming or rental service, with Audible, you own your books. And second, they have the Great Listen Guarantee. You didn't like it, you can simply swap it out. Now luckily for me, with my recent purchase, I didn't have to swap it out. I've been reading Stephen King since I picked up Carrie at age 13, but recently I went on a road trip and was able to download a copy of his short story collection, The Bazaar of Bad Dreams. It was an experience unlike any other way I processed his words before, and that's because the audiobook was read by great actors such as Hope Davis, Dylan Baker, Fred Weller, and Edward Herman. So once again, Undisclosed listeners, you get a special offer. Simply go to www.audible.com/undisclosed. You'll get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial.
Now, Colin, actually, this is the first time that I've had a chance to talk to you after the state's appeal was lodged in the Adnan Syed case. And I actually had a couple of questions about that. I know that Judge Welch cited the Curtis case in terms of the knowing and intelligent waiver issue. And then the state came back in the appeal and said that they didn't know of any cases where that had been cited in cases of ineffective assistance of counsel. First of all, can you explain to me why that would matter in the state's appeal? And then could you let me know how on earth you found a case in 5 minutes?
Yeah, so this goes back to the waiver issue in Adnan's case, and essentially Maryland courts have a dichotomy between fundamental rights and non-fundamental rights. And they say if it's a fundamental right, the only way you can waive it and not raise it at a later point in time is if your waiver was knowing and intelligent. And there's this case, Curtis versus State from 1978, which said this is a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. You're guaranteed the right to counsel under the Sixth Amendment. Therefore, it's a fundamental right that you have effective assistance of counsel, and therefore the defendant, Curtis, couldn't waive that right unless it was knowing and intelligent. And as you know, the state in their application for leave to appeal says, well, in our search, we haven't found any subsequent Maryland cases that have applied this knowing and intelligent waiver rule to a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. As you say, why would that matter? It wouldn't really. For instance, Adnan cited a case out of Maryland, In re Paris, which dealt with ineffective assistance based upon the handling of alibi witnesses. There were no subsequent Maryland cases on that point, but Judge Welch easily found that Christina Gutierrez was unreasonable by failing to contact Asia McClain. So it wouldn't really matter unless there actually was an opinion in Maryland saying we're overruling Curtis and finding the knowing and intelligent rule doesn't apply to ineffective assistance. But that said, yeah, I just went on Westlaw. I did a quick search, and the very first result of a pretty basic Westlaw search of those terms came up with State versus Adams. It was a case out of Maryland in 2008, and very specifically, it was dealing with defense counsel not objecting to jury instructions at the end of trial. And the court very clearly in that case found, as in Curtis, this is a claim of ineffective assistance. It's a fundamental right. We're applying the knowing and intelligent waiver rule. So yeah, there is other Maryland precedent out there which directly refutes the state's point about lack of Maryland precedent.
I knew the state was in for a bad time when they had to preface their claim with, our preliminary search has not uncovered anything.
That's a cover your ass phrase?
It means they haven't done enough of the search to actually be confident what they found. They wanted it to sound good.
But see, now, does that indicate that the state is just not trying very hard or that they're inept? Or both?
I mean, I did what I thought was the clearest search you would do, and it was the very first result. There's a thing known as shepherdizing in the legal world, which is essentially, nowadays at least, you go into Westlaw or Lexis, which are the search engines for cases. You plug in a case like Curtis versus State, and you click on a button, and the fourth result for that was State versus Adams. So, I mean, really, if they were doing even the most basic search, I don't see how they could have missed this case that was reaching the same conclusion as the Curtis case.
But doesn't this beg the question? I mean, if this is the level of effort they're putting into this, is this moral and ethical for them to do this? And I say that because there is a human being in jail who is being deprived of their freedom at this moment. And the appeal that they're doing, it feels like they're just in lockstep at this point. They're defending a decision, the original conviction of Adnan, that is very hollow, that doesn't seem to have any real evidence anymore. And so I'm asking you, what is the state's obligation? Why would they keep doing this in this sort of odd automatic lockstep when it doesn't appear that they're necessarily trying all that hard?
Yeah, the prosecutor in this case, the state attorney's general's office, the client is the people of the state of Maryland. And a little bit more specifically, although not directly, it is representing Haman Lee and her family. The claim by Maryland would be, we are representing our state because we believe Adnan Syed is a murderer. He is a dangerous person. We believe that this was a constitutionally valid conviction. We're going to do everything to fight to secure it. But as you know, John, it doesn't really seem that they have a legal leg to stand on. Judge Welch's opinion was very well researched and written. And even if they might have a claim in terms of waiver with regard to the cell tower issue, the Asia McClain issue on appeal, I think, is almost a slam dunk for the defense if it comes to a cross appeal. So, yeah, I mean, they would claim we're representing the state of Maryland. Many people would say you're wasting our taxpayer dollars. This is a person who has had his conviction rendered invalid. Why are you fighting so hard to try to reverse this ruling that seems pretty ironclad?
And exactly. And for them to retry the case, okay, that's honestly fair, in my opinion. If they honestly believe that they have the evidence, then by all means, retry the case. If they say these two sisters that have come forward to invalidate Asia's testimony are for real, great, bring them forward and actually retry the case and let this man either go or be convicted. But the appeal to me is where it crosses an ethical line, because it's just a delaying tactic. Would they be doing that? And by the way, I'm trying to read into it to some degree that they're trying to do their job well, or, you know, they absolutely believe that Adnan is guilty, or something, some actual moral way for them to wake up every morning and go to work and feel like they're doing a good job. But in the appeal, I can't find that because it seems like it's just a delaying tactic, just a way to keep Adnan in jail as long as possible.
I think that they realize that they have almost no chance of securing a conviction after a retrial, especially after some of the statements that Jay Wilds has made, especially after some of the findings, especially with regard to lividity, the cell tower pings, etc. They know this is their only shot. If they can somehow get a reversal of Judge Welch's opinion granting a new trial, that's their best shot, because if it goes to a new trial, it's going to be a PR nightmare, it's going to be a jury nightmare, it is going to be an expert witness nightmare. There's just no legitimate chance they have of winning a conviction on retrial.
And Julie, actually, I wanted to bring up something with you. You wrote a very interesting op-ed in the New York Times about the fact that it doesn't seem like the Constitution protects an innocent person from being incarcerated merely on the fact that they are, in fact, innocent. You mentioned a case of a man named Sandeep Bharatiya. Could you tell us a little bit more about that case and the implications of innocence and constitutional law?
Mr. Bharatiya is one of the clients of the Georgia Innocence Project, and he didn't become our client, though, until a few years ago. So at his original trial, he was convicted of a sexual assault that happened in a little town called Thunderbolt, Georgia, which is near Savannah. And it was a kind of home invasion. It started out, I think, as sort of a burglary, but then this young woman walked in on the person and he blindfolded her and sexually assaulted her. And he used a glove. He wore a glove, and it was a very distinctive glove. It was a sort of baseball glove, I believe it was described as, a blue and white baseball glove. And she was very specific about the glove. So a little bit later, the police found her stuff and the glove at a woman's house. The woman's name is Ashley Dold. And Ashley Dold said, "My boyfriend, Sterling Flint, asked if he could put this stuff at my house." So the police went to Sterling Flint and he said, "Oh yeah, I put it there, but it's not my stuff. It belonged to this guy, Sandeep Bharatiya. He gave it to me, he asked me to hold it for him." So that's how they got to Bharatiya. And at the time of the trial counsel never asked for any DNA testing. So we don't really know why the lawyer didn't ask for DNA testing, but he did not. And so later, after the conviction, there was a request for DNA testing. There was a motion for a new trial, and the judge granted the request to test the gloves. Other evidence has been lost, but they tested the gloves. And at the time they tested the gloves, outside the gloves was a woman's DNA. We assume it was the victim, but the state didn't want to test her DNA. So we don't know for sure, but we think it was her DNA. On the inside of the gloves was an unidentified male, but it was not Bharatiya's DNA inside the gloves. At that time, the judge said, "Well, that's not enough for a new trial. Just the fact that there were cells inside the glove, but they weren't his, not enough for a new trial." So years later, I think 2008, or maybe even later than that, the Georgia Innocence Project comes on board. And we make another motion for testing of that DNA. And the judge says, "Well, I'm not going to retest it, but in the alternative, they ask for it to be run through the CODIS database." CODIS is kind of a centralized database where all the DNA from all the states and federal system goes in there, and it stays there and it gets indexed. So eventually the judge said, "Well, yeah, we might as well run it through CODIS. Like, there's no harm in running it through." They run it through CODIS, and lo and behold, whose DNA is that inside the glove? It's Sterling Flint, the witness who testified against Bharatiya at the trial, the one who, you know, gave his girlfriend the stuff. And so at that time, Bharatiya moves for a new trial based on this new evidence, this DNA that's not his, but it's the co-defendant who had testified against him. And the court denied it. And the court denied it based on a case law in Georgia that says that in order to get a new trial, one of the things you have to show, in addition to showing that there would probably be a different result based on this new evidence, which the court said, yes, you satisfy that prong of the test. But another prong of the test is a due diligence prong. And that means that the defendant who's asking for a new trial based on new evidence has to show that they exercised diligence at the time, that they didn't lack diligence in not asking for it at the time of the trial. They had some good reason not to ask for it then. And they couldn't show that. I mean, there really was no reason why they didn't ask for it then, or if there was a reason, we don't really know what it was. And so they fail the due diligence prong. And so this goes all the way to the Georgia Supreme Court, which says, okay, right, you know, it doesn't matter. You have to satisfy that prong of the test. So even if you have, I'm paraphrasing here.
Yes, I one would hope.
I'm using some artistic license, though not all that much. So this is a unanimous decision by the Georgia Supreme Court, essentially saying, even if you satisfy every other prong of the test, so even if you show that you have new evidence that proves that you are innocent, it doesn't matter if you fail the due diligence prong. You have to satisfy that prong. So if you don't have a good reason why you didn't test it before, even though it's great evidence of innocence, tough luck. And so the op-ed I wrote, I was incensed. So when that decision came down, like that minute, I started writing this op-ed.
Yeah, you can feel that when you read it. You feel the seething rage. Like,
exactly. It was just, it's so frustrating because, and so the bottom line is that, and this has been discussed in the sort of legal academic literature quite a bit, but the Supreme Court has never decided the question whether there's a constitutional right to be released upon a showing of actual innocence. So this is what they call a freestanding claim of innocence, meaning it's not based on any procedural or any additional constitutional defect. So it wasn't ineffective assistance of counsel. It wasn't like a invalid search and seizure or a Fifth Amendment violation or any kind of specific defect in the trial that you can point to. It's its own claim, sort of freestanding, just floating out there, is innocence in and of itself its own constitutional claim. And the Supreme Court has repeatedly sort of had the opportunity to answer that question, and it has always punted the question. It's always been able to decide a case on some other basis and not had to address that question. But so this is the kind of thing where I think regular people, like normal people, people who aren't lawyers, they are appalled that this could be the constitutional law or that it even possibly might be. And even law students, like I always bring this up in evidence every year. And so I tell my second year students, you know, you're not fully brainwashed yet. You know, you're not done with law school. And so what do you think about this? Do you think that this is legal? And they're generally, you know, completely appalled. So, for example, I'll read you a quote from Justice Scalia from an old case. This court, meaning the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has never held that the Constitution forbids the execution of a convicted defendant who has had a full and fair trial, but is later able to convince a habeas court that he is, quote, actually, close quote, innocent. There's a lot of quotations like that that I could read you. And so far, the Supreme Court has not answered the question.
Well, it appears that constitutionally, it's just about guarding the integrity of the process and not at all about the integrity of what in reality occurred. Does that differ from state to state? Do all the states have different ways of dealing with the actual innocence?
Yeah, they do. So the U.S. Constitution, if the Supreme Court decided this question, that would apply everywhere, right? But the states have their own constitutions as well, and the state constitution could provide higher protection than the U.S. Constitution, and often the state constitutions do that. And so some state courts have held that their own state constitution does provide an actual innocence claim, and then some lower federal courts, and I'm sure Colin knows the answer to this because, Colin, you know everything, but I don't have the specifics, but I know that some lower courts, federal courts, have held that there is a federal freestanding innocence constitutional claim, but that hasn't been decided by the Supreme Court, so we don't know what the Supreme Court would say about it. But depending on what state you're in, you might have a claim, but it's not guaranteed by the, at least we don't know yet that whether it's guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution.
As a non-attorney, I want to say you're right. I am appalled.
Yeah,
thank you,
it's appalling. And can I, it's just one more thing. When I wrote that op-ed, I got a lot of email. And one email was from a guy who teaches some sort of criminal justice course at a college, like I think it was in Wisconsin. And he gave me an article that he was working on, a comparative article about Germany versus the U.S. And he basically said he wanted to use the op-ed as part of his syllabus. And he said, in Germany, they much more look at the substantive truth.
As opposed to the process.
As opposed to the process. So the U.S. is very proceduralist and other systems are much more substantive. And I think that that's probably true. And we protect procedure in order to protect substance, among other values. So it's not that our system doesn't care about the truth. That's what all the procedures are for, or largely for. But it's like when you have this clear conflict, then our system sometimes prefers finality over truth.
Well, your op-ed actually hinted that the worry was that by opening up the thing to things other than procedural errors, it was opening up Pandora's box and allowing people to endlessly contradict their rulings. Do you think that played into it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's the main worry. And I think that the concern about finality is legitimate, but it's like taking it to its most ridiculous, illogical extreme, because there are ways that you could protect against every single convicted person raising every single kind of crazy claim versus we have DNA evidence that is pretty conclusive. And we have no forum to present it.
Colin, do you have any idea how this would have arose in terms of, because you know a lot more about the history of the legal system in the United States than I do. How would this particular type of logic arise in the system?
Well, I can say specifically, and I wanted to sort of follow up with Julie on this, is my understanding is that in Georgia, this was a 2011 law with regard to DNA testing, and it was Stephanie Benfield who sponsored it. And there was a lot of pushback, and she wanted basically it to be easier to appeal on DNA grounds, but there was a lot of opposition, and that led to Georgia having a pretty restrictive avenue of relief for people claiming to be DNA exonerees. And this isn't isolated because there's another case, and actually there's going to be a podcast premiering on this case. It's the Devonia Inman case, and Inman was convicted of murdering a Taco Bell worker during a robbery, and there was a viable alternate suspect, and eventually DNA testing was done. There was a ski mask found in the victim's car, and it turned back as a match for this alternate suspect in the case. But despite that, Julie Wright, there was no relief granted to Inman, and he's still incarcerated.
That's right. And so Devonia Inman is also one of the Georgia Innocence Project's clients. And a law professor at Georgia State Law School named Jesse Sino is the pro bono lawyer who's working on that and working on that podcast. And it's a very similar situation, actually, where you have DNA evidence that points to this alternate suspect, and there's sort of no forum in which to present it. But in terms of the law, Stephanie Stuckey Benfield, that's what she said. She says it was sort of a compromise, and we didn't clarify it because we had pushback from the prosecutors. But if you look at the DNA testing law, Georgia was pretty out front on that. We had one of the earlier DNA testing laws, and it seems pretty clear that the purpose of it was to allow innocent defendants to be able to show evidence of their innocence. But what happened in this case with the Georgia Supreme Court is that there's another law, a more general law, just about new evidence and new trials. And the court sort of read those two together. So where it seems like it would make sense for the later law, the DNA law, to sort of override the earlier law in terms of the diligence requirement, since they're sort of slightly different, the court didn't do that. It said, no, the general test, this Timberlake test, that's a case from 1980, way before DNA, that test applies to any new evidence, including DNA evidence, and regardless of what the DNA statute really says.
Yeah, and John, bigger picture, if we're talking about why would states place these limitations on appeals, I was actually just at a conference and we were discussing sentencing reform, and this goes back to the interview episode I did on bipartisan justice. There's a lot of bipartisan support for sentencing reform, getting rid of mandatory minimums, decreasing criminal sentences. And you always wonder, well, what's guiding bipartisan work? It is budget. And that is, a state like Georgia is very conscious of the state budget and how much money they're spending. And if they're approving a wide-ranging DNA appeal bill that allows people more readily to appeal, to prove their innocence, to get compensation from the state, obviously that's going to be a hit on the state budget. So financially speaking, of course, states have an incentive to limit the avenues for relief. You might look at that on an ethical basis and say that doesn't make sense. But, you know, unfortunately, unlike sentencing reform, which generally dovetails with budget consciousness in terms of appellate relief, that's something where if you're looking at the state pocketbook, you're not going to want to approve wider avenues for appeal.
Okay. But there's all kinds of issues where the state has budgetary reasons for pursuing certain laws or not pursuing certain laws, but they forego them in the interest of justice. So I would have to hope that in the future they reconsider that.
Not all ingredients are created equal. Fresh, high-quality ingredients taste better and are better for you, so it's important to know where your food comes from. For less than $10 per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created weekly and are not repeated within a year. You can choose your meals from a variety of recipes, or you can let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. For instance, I can say from my own experience, I'm a pescatarian, so no beef, no chicken. Some of the options this week are seared cod and summer succotash, summer vegetable gnocchi, and spicy sweet and sour tofu. But Blue Apron's also flexible. You can customize your recipes each week based on your preferences, and you can choose delivery options to fit your needs. There's no weekly commitments, so you only get deliveries when you want them. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/up. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/up. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Now, I wanted to actually get into the fifth episode of Undisclosed, which was the Drive to Cedartown episode. And the team dug into the minutiae of the Joey Watkins timeline and how it could have possibly intersected with Isaac Dawkins' shooting. And it seemed to me, in listening to it, that the details actually much more supported an alibi than some way to find Joey Watkins guilty. So I wondered how... Obviously, the prosecution in the case framed it as this is the work of a criminal mastermind. That Joey Watkins had planned all this out or not. They also seemed to suggest that it was the act of somebody who was just rashly angry. And in going over the details, it's hard to avoid the conclusion that if Joey Watkins was actually intending to kill Isaac Dawkins, the crime was either meticulously planned, really poorly planned, ineptly carried out, or just a miracle of timing. And how can the prosecution possibly argue all those things at once? And obviously, I'm sure we'll get into it in later episodes, but how did they do it?
It doesn't matter how Joey did it. They don't care about that. Their case consisted of showing how terrible person Joey supposedly was and how he hated Isaac more than anyone should possibly be able to hate anything and therefore draw your own conclusions. They didn't care how it happened. They didn't focus on that because, well, what are they going to focus on? So, I mean, literally not one person has ever been able to tell me, how do you think Joey committed this crime? What do you think actually happened? No one can answer that because there is no answer.
Well, yes, he either had to know exactly where Isaac Dawkins was, where and when he was leaving school. So he would have had to wait there. But obviously he wasn't there because at 6:48, he was at home, either about to take a shower or about to leave. But either way, he doesn't know where Isaac Dawkins is. Then he has to hope that he's going to, he either has to follow him or just hope that he runs into him, which, you know, again, is not a very good plan. See, this was the same thing that when I was looking over the Adnan Syed case, when everybody, you know, along with the world in Serial and listening to Undisclosed, the actual plan of the crime seems so dumb, you know, that who would possibly work that way? And I'm just amazed that prosecutions can get around this issue to juries. Susan, can you speculate on, you know, how the jury could have put that together? Because you've actually read the transcript.
Like, they didn't need to, because that really wasn't something that concerned them. I've spoken to jurors, and so far, not one of them can tell me even if they thought this was a premeditated crime or a spur-of-the-moment crime. It could have been either. The prosecution, in their closing and opening arguments, does argue it both ways. So it's just not an issue in this case how Joey did it. The only issue is that Joey's a terrible person and he hated Isaac. The defense should have done better of actually presenting what happened here. That's where things went horrible. Well, it's one of the places where it went horribly awry.
And I had a couple of very specific questions about the episode. There was a couple of things. First of all, I was looking at the evidence photographs. And if you can get a chance, folks, do log on to undisclosed-podcast.com and check out the evidence photos. Because something that was unclear to me, there's that big silver box that is laying near Isaac Dawkins' truck, his pickup truck. Is that the toolbox that everybody's been talking about?
Yeah, that's the toolbox.
Okay. And at some point, I believe it was Tandy, Joey's sister, who talks about the fact that he saw Isaac Dawkins' toolbox, or rather, Joey asked her if Isaac Dawkins' pickup had a toolbox in it. But the prosecution rests its Joey Lied assertion on the fact that he didn't see the brush guard in the front.
Or the
toolbox,
actually.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. So I did not hear that part of it.
Well, we didn't include it because it seems so silly, because it's in the photos. I mean, you can see the toolbox. I don't even know why they're trying to claim Joey couldn't have seen the toolbox. It's front and center.
Yeah, the toolbox looks like it's right next to the road. I don't know. Perhaps it's hard to tell the geography of the photos at times.
No, you're right. It's easily visible from someone on 27.
And plus, as he claimed, if the police had shut down one of the lanes and had slowed down the traffic, he would have even more time to see those things.
Yeah, and we know that Joey, when he, according to his timeline, according to the call to his sister, the time when he would have passed Isaac's truck, that door would have been closed still, the driver's side door, which means he would have had an unobstructed view to the front of the, where the brush guard and the headlights would have been. So the fact their only picture of that view has the door open and blocking it, wow.
I struggle with the photographer. I've heard you say so many times that, what's the photographer's name, Clyde? He took, hundreds of pictures every time and you have less than 20. So it's just a big struggle for me. Where do all these pictures that he normally takes go?
Clyde has got to be so sick of Claire and Eva at this point. because that's what we keep asking for months and months and months. And we're getting nowhere.
Now, I wanted to go to some Twitter questions, actually, because we got one from Twitter user Olive, who asks, can you re-explain the choreography of Isaac's truck and the blue Honda in the moments before the shooting? We've also got questions about, was Mr. Benson, who I believe was the witness, asking if there might, had he seen anybody else in either car? Did he have any idea of how many people were in either car?
My husband was saying that we should make a GTA reenactment of this.
Actually, I would really love if somebody could do some graphics, because as you mentioned, there were so many different versions that the prosecution told of Joey either driving past, driving north, then driving south, then turning back around. And I would love to see some explanation of those scenarios, because it is very hard for me to understand them.
I made a little image of what Benson saw, and I can post that. Trying to sort of graph out what the prosecution's arguing is, it almost, basically you have to make the argument for them because they never did it. So I could draw a bunch of squiggly lines on a map and say, hey, here's how Joey did it. But the prosecution never did that. They never actually decided how it happened.
Oh, so that would be a fool's errand to try and scope those things out?
Yeah, was he parked at the college? Was he parked at the gas station across the street? Was he driving south on 27 when he saw Isaac's truck and made a quick U-turn and started following him? Were they at one point stopped and then started driving? Were they always doing a cat and mouse where they're driving back and forth and jockeying? Yeah, after the shooting, does the truck with Isaac, unconscious, veer off into the other lane, or does it stop and then people get out and push it across the median into the woods? So there's just so many different permutations, it's tough to say exactly what the state's theory would look like, because there's just, it's a multitude of options.
And you have to add in, too, it's not just that. You also have to add in the timeline, and there's many permutations here, where Joey picked up his accomplice, where Joey switched out the cars, where Joey dropped off the accomplice, how he got to Cedartown afterwards, where he went after, did he take the accomplice home? Did he take him to his, yeah. So there's probably, if you added up all the combinations of stories, God, it's got to be at least 100.
Can I ask a question that I hope I'm not jumping ahead to something that you're going to do later, but how did the bullet enter Isaac's head? Was it in the back of his head or through the side? Do they think the bullet came from through the back window or through the driver's side window or what?
It went, we know where it hit the right side of his head above the ear and went left and up.
Kind of the back of his head or the side?
Mostly the side, above the ear. But in terms of which window it went through, I mean, there's a lot of versions. I mean, the witnesses give all kinds of stories about which window. There's not any sort of consensus there. I think the prosecution theory, the one they most strongly go to eventually, at the preliminary hearing, it's a different theory altogether. But by the time they get to trial, they're saying that the bullet hit the back window, sliding pane, the one on the driver's side closer to Isaac. Mm-hmm. But right. I am very skeptical of that because there's no evidence of it. And if you look at the windows, it very much seems like it is the passenger side window that got hit. the back passenger side window.
And well, but and we also have no idea what angle his head was. I mean, if he was looking to the side, then it could have hit his right side. Another Twitter question was from Donna Scott, who is, I believe, one of our followers from the UK. She says, we know there are only a few terrible photos, but just what is State's exhibit number 23-62601? That's not even in situ, in exclamation point. And I love that she's getting indignant about it. Like, what is that doing there? She's probably right, by the way. Do you have any memory of that, Susan?
I wish I could say that I know this case well enough where I...
just wait, the number alone.
I'm pretty sure she's talking about the one taken at Joey's house, maybe. That was taken about a week later. Detective Mosher at the Rome Police Department. So basically, there's this whole, like, they want to make it Joey. So they got to find a way Joey could have done it. So they go on the hunt for the blue Hondish car that he could have been in. And so for a while, the closest they get is his sister's Tandy's car, which is a greenish Sunfire. So Mosher, like, went to their house all, like, incognito and like took photos of Tandy's car at the Watkins house, and it's that photo.
Because there were people questioning whether, I think it was Benson, was sure that the Honda was blue, and it was at night, so it is a difficult color to discern at that time.
Yeah, yeah. There's definitely a lot. He thinks it's blue, but I mean, it's very well could not be blue too.
Yeah, sunset was at 5:50 p.m. that day. Obviously, the shooting was about 7:19 p.m., so it was well after sunset. I think, Susan, you disagree with this, and you've talked to Wayne Benson, but there's some question about whether he's colorblind or not, so that's another issue. But then also it's just if you're seeing something as stressful as someone driving off the road to their death, you know, the color of the vehicle probably isn't foremost in your mind. It's easy to see the mind possibly playing tricks. So I'm not convinced at all it's a blue car. I think it's a possibility, but it's easily possible it could be another color.
I got another question from Sahar, who says, do we know for a fact that Isaac was alone in the truck? What if a passenger shot him, then fled?
I think that's one we actually can be totally confident about. He was alone in the truck.
Also, I have to say, it would be kind of unwise if you're in the truck with somebody else driving to actually shoot the driver. I don't know. I might think twice before I did that. I mean, things would have to be going pretty badly in the car.
Before that's your go-to strategy.
Yes, exactly. But you never know. I mean, I'm known to act rashly. A lot of people are also asking, what on earth is a brush guard? I have to say, I'm from New York City. I've never come in contact with one of those.
I didn't realize we needed to explain it, but clearly we did. A brush guard is the metal grill thingy on the front of a truck or other car. It depends what you're using it for, but it's to sort of keep the bumper from getting torn up by like heavy brush or whatever. They are also called bull bars or roo bars in Australia. And apparently, according to Wikipedia, moose bumpers in Canada.
Yes, we have those in New York. We also got a Twitter question from Thievu Fromul 2, who asks, why does Susan talk so fast? Oh, that's the view from LL2. Oh, okay. Now I understand that. By the way, I thoroughly enjoy your particular delivery, Susan. I'm going to say that on my behalf. But it's great because you talk absolutely normally, and then you speed up like three words. You pack them all into one syllable. It's actually remarkably efficient. We should be grateful that you can do that. It's remarkable.
Yeah.
I had one other very specific question for Susan. At one point, you mentioned that Aslan has no reason to lie on Joey's behalf because by the time the trial rolled around, they had become estranged. What am I reading into that, or what happened between them?
They had an ugly breakup. And as we'll get into, I mean, they dated, I think, till August. So 8 months after Isaac's murder, they were still together. But there were some heavy influences against a lot of people, but including Aslan and her family, which I think were a big contributor to why they had a falling out.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's understandable that a relationship would be under pressure with that type of investigation going on. And Joey, as you pointed out, he knew that he was under investigation pretty quickly. Am I right?
The next day, very early, yes.
But you seem to hint that the police went in and out of suspecting him. Is that something we'll get into in a future episode?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the police aren't a monolith. There are, even in the same force, you're going to have different views and different things. And here we have the complication of two different police forces working on the case. and they weren't always on the same page about things.
Well, one of them, Mike Key, was into helping suspects from making incriminating statements. I thought that was fascinating that it seemed, well, at least according to Joey, that there was an officer who seemed to be trying to keep him from saying things that might come back to haunt him.
Yeah, it seems like that, again, the police aren't a monolith, and this officer didn't think Joey had done it. So when he's taking Joey's statement and Joey starts getting into like a very full account of his day, he's like, whoa, 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 let's make this a more generalized statement and prevent you from talking yourself into trouble.
Which is really unusual. I mean, I don't
know. Well, is it?
I don't know. Brooke, has any of your exonerees run into that? It would seem like the opposite was by and large true.
I have rarely heard an exoneree say, no, the police were trying to help me.
So it's fascinating to me. I'm hoping, do you ever get a chance to actually talk with Mike Key?
I have not spoken to him. No, we've spoken to some officers, but at this point, as you might imagine, Rome and Floyd County aren't exactly receptive to us.
Yeah, but John, to your point, I think either episode 6 or 7, the next episode or the following episode, we'll get into those handoff issues with Floyd County and Rome. And I think it'll be pretty illuminating for the audience to hear what exactly was going on.
Yeah, Julie, so you're familiar with the case. You've heard us talk about it before, I know.
Uh-huh.
But you don't know all the details. You aren't in the weeds like Claire is. Was
right.
there anything in this episode that was surprising to you?
No, I don't think so. But I do have just this one thing that's bugging me about. I'm really like directionally challenged. But the truck was driving northbound, but it ends up facing southbound. So it spins around. It does like a 180.
It also rolls over and does a 180. I'm still not very clear on how it happened. But when you get enough force going, weird things can happen in a wreck.
And well, that's like how rolls they know over it was upside down?
Yeah, it did at least one total roll. Mm-hmm. Like my guess is it was like doing a 180. In the middle of the 180, it also does a barrel roll.
Yeah, it appears that because the toolbox was ejected from the back of the pickup, you can see that there's a wire from the toolbox to what I guess is some sort of electrical outlet in the back of the pickup. And I'm assuming, I've been an actor since I was 18, so my proficiency with power tools is limited. But I guess it is some sort of electrical outlet to charge power tools or charge batteries or something like that. But at any rate, you can see that the truck must have rolled so violently that the back part of that portion must have actually separated slightly from the cab, because the wire is actually stuck between the cab and the truck bed apparatus, which to me indicates that it must have been an incredibly violent rollover. I don't know how somebody would have survived even that.
I mean, Isaac's only injury, really, other than a couple bruises, was the gunshot wound. So he wasn't really hurt in the accident itself. And they never really did it. They never did an accident reconstruction. They never did a crime scene reconstruction here. So it's hard to tell what happened with the car. But one detail that's always struck me as really bizarre is a note about evidence recovery and how they recovered change from the cup holder. Like, how is there still change in the cup holder?
My cup holder has a lot of Diet Coke in it.
What about, were their phones hands-free then? Or would Joey have been talking on the phone, holding the phone in one of his hands?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, despite the fact that is, you know, unwise to do, but I don't believe there were actually laws against that at that point. I think it was just what everybody did, you know.
Right. But then he clearly couldn't be holding the steering wheel and the phone and a gun. So if that's right. The case, there had to be another person if the bullet came from his car.
Yeah.
And the state's theory is, I mean, because Aslan didn't hear the gunshot, he'd somehow having to use his hand to cover the cell phone so that she wouldn't hear the gunshot, unless they're claiming, again, that she's sick, and because of that, somehow she wouldn't be able to hear a gunshot right next to the phone.
Yeah, I love the idea that he, like, calls his girlfriend up, is chatting to her randomly, casual, like, I'm on my way to see you, hope you're feeling better. But then he, like, asks her a question that he knows is going to get her started. Like, so tell me what your friend Brenda said at school today. And she starts going off. He puts it on mute, fires the gun, and then, like, puts her back on talk and keeps going.
Well, again, very often prosecutions, and they did this in the Adnan Syed case, they present ordinary things that people do every day as the acts of a sociopath, because they're put in the context of supposedly committing a murder. Like, you know, Anand going back to the mosque that night. Oh, what a sociopath, you know. And we actually have a Twitter question from Sarada who says, okay, for real, question. Why does mastermind/sociopath explanation fly in these cases? And I actually have a theory, if you guys want to hear it.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. Hey, thanks, guys. It is because when you're on a jury, you don't want to feel like you're being a party to the crime, that you're actually making the crime worse. And if you feel like this is somebody genuinely dangerous that is being tried here for whatever set of reasons, and I guess the prosecution in this case set it up that Joey was this very angry guy who was super enraged at Isaac Dawkins, but you feel like you don't want to be taken for a fool. In some respect, like if somebody was a criminal mastermind, you would be the one who'd catch on to it. And that's it. Guilty. You know, that's my theory, but I don't know if you guys have other ones.
I think in this case, it absolutely applies. I think there was a very real sense that this type of evil, and that's the word multiple jurors have used, this kind of evil is not something that they could let go and let be free in the street again.
Huh. Well, I think that like working in the mental health profession, we don't use the word psychopath or sociopath very often. We use a lot of personality disorders, which are very similar. And actually, Joey isn't the one who sends me those signals. It's actually Brianne. And I think that, you know, a personality disorder is something that is similar to like a mood disorder, but it comes from upbringing. So I think that I would really like to know more about the life circumstances of these people before saying that they're a sociopath or that they are a psychopath or someone who without a conscience.
One of the things kind of like the pop culture things that permeates about sociopaths or psychopaths is that they're charming. It's like the Ted Bundy, you know, he's charming. And I think that part of it is when you listen to whether it's, you know, Adnan in the tapes or Joey, you know, he sounds like a nice guy. He sounds normal. He sounds charming. He sounds like he's really trying to just tell the truth. And I think, you know, what John said about like, a juror doesn't want to feel like something's being put over on them. Like you could think, oh, well, sociopaths are good at that. They're good at sounding like they're charming. And it kind of goes to what you all were saying about the alibi on the episode, which is like, it didn't matter what he said, they were going to use it against him if he was specific or if he was general. If he, you know, had a really good alibi, that was going to be evidence against him, or if he had no alibi. It's kind of like just this whole confirmation bias. It's like once you decide what you think happened, then you're going to read everything through that lens. You're going to filter it through and you're going to make it fit with what you think happened.
Thank you guys so much for being here today. I appreciate it so much. It's always fascinating. And I'm very excited about the future episodes of Undisclosed. And hopefully you all will get a chance to come back and we will talk some more. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks.
For the past few weeks, I've been dedicating my fees from the addendum to organizations helping the wrongly convicted. So this week, the folks I would like to let you know about are the Equal Justice Initiative, and it's a private, nonprofit organization that provides legal representation to indigent defendants and prisoners who've been denied fair and just treatment in the legal system. They litigate on behalf of condemned prisoners, juvenile offenders, people wrongly convicted or charged with violent crimes, poor people denied effective representation, and others whose trials are marked by racial bias or prosecutorial misconduct. They are at www.eji.org, and they were brought to us by Aileen1121, so thank you, as well as a few other people's. And I believe actually one of their cases was featured on 60 Minutes recently, so they've been doing some great work. Fans can discuss the show on Twitter at #undisclosed or #JoeyWatkins. If you want to tag questions for future addenda, you can use #UDaddendum, or you can tweet them directly to me at Mr. John Cryer. Also, if you've got any worthy organizations for the wrongfully convicted, I've got a few so far. I've actually got a lot, but I always like to hear about more, and you can send them to me, and I will highlight them here on the show. And as always, there's new case documents posted weekly at undisclosed-podcast.com. There are evidence photos, and there's much, much to go over there. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the handle @UndisclosedPod, and also our key partner, the Georgia Innocence Project, at GA Innocence. I want to thank Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media for our audio production. Got to thank Patrick Cortez for composing the new addenda theme. I listened to that song, and it sounds like Injustice to me. It's incredibly evocative. I also want to thank Meethal Telhan as our project manager. She keeps the trains running on time. Okay, sorry about the Mussolini reference, Meethal. And I just wanted to say, unfortunately, I will not be hosting next week. I will be traveling once again. But as you probably know, last week we had a young lady by the name of Rabia Chaudhry, who was our host, and she was pretty freaking fantastic. So things go pretty well when I'm not around. I will be back the week after that, and we'll be settling in for a good long run of future Addenda episodes. So till then, thanks for listening.
I need to make a confession, though, because this has been eating at me since I knew I was going to be on here.
Okay.
I've never seen the Ducky movie.
By the way, that was the original title, just so you know. It wasn't Pretty in Pink. It was the Ducky movie.